Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 26th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, audiobooks to help us understand the world. On this episode, I was joined by Dr. Blair Bigham, author of the book Death Interrupted, How Modern Medicine is Complicating the Way We Die. Doctors today can call on previously unimaginable technologies to help keep our bodies alive, where in this era, most organs can be kept from dying almost indefinitely by machines. But this unprecedented shift in end-of-life care has created a major crisis. In the widening grey zone between life and death, doctors fight with doctors, families feel pressured to make tough decisions about their loved ones, and lawyers are left to argue life and death causes in courts. Meanwhile, intensive care patients are caught in purgatory, attached to machines and unable to speak for themselves. In Death Interrupted, Dr. Blair Bigham seeks to help readers understand the options facing them at the end of their lives, through conversations with end-of-life professionals, including ethicists, social workers, and nurses and doctors who practice palliative care, and observations from his own time working in ambulances, emergency rooms, and the ICU. Dr. Bigham exposes the tensions inherent in this new era of dying and answers the tough questions facing us all, because now, for the first time in history, we may be able to choose how our own story ends. It was great discussing the book with Blair. Hope you enjoy the episode. You say that this book is about the day-to-day struggle caused by too much medicine, the new grey zone. Just for context, do you mind elaborating on what this space is?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a new liminal space that hasn't really existed before, where death is unclear and our ability to prevent it is unclear. It used to be, before we had ventilators and technology, that if you couldn't breathe on your own, you were definitely going to die within a matter of minutes. But nowadays, we have all these machines that can replace your kidneys with dialysis and your lungs with a ventilator and your heart with an ECMO machine. And so we can keep you alive physiologically pretty easily. But we don't always know when we've reached the limit of whether or not we can get you better, whether or not you'll ever be able to leave the hospital. And so we're sort of in this gray zone sometimes where you're not dead yet, but we don't really know if we can get you off of these machines and living on your own.
Blair, you initially was a paramedic. And what's interesting, and what I actually learned from, I never thought about it like this, but I learned from listening to the audiobook, is that as a paramedic, when you brought the patient to the hospital and they were still alive, you've more or less done your job. But you never used to hear much about how the patient was doing after you've done that. How different did your outlook on what it means to be alive change once you became a physician? Because you are now a part of the next stage of the treatment process.
Yeah, that's right. As a paramedic, you know, if they had a pulse at the door, I had done my job, right? I got them to the hospital alive. But what that means is that a physician now has to take that case forward and ultimately get that person to recover, to wake up, to be off of medicines and off of machines and go back home. And so when I transitioned from being a paramedic to a physician, I was now in that position where now I had to up my game and figure out, okay, yeah, they have a pulse, they're not dead, but how am I going to get this person to be able to enjoy life again, to be able to leave my care and go back home with their family, go back to their jobs, go back to their hobbies? And so that was a very interesting experience because I thought I had a really good grasp on what it meant to resuscitate someone. I mean, that's what paramedics do day in and day out. And then I got to the hospital and started working in the emergency department and the ICU, and that became a lot more complex. And at some point, I began to enter these situations that were a lot less certain than when I had been a paramedic.
Is there a particular moment in time, from a medical as well as a cultural perspective, would you say that contributed to us becoming uncomfortable to talk about death as well as to even think about death?
Yeah, I learned a lot talking to historians and sociologists when I was writing this book about how we've sort of gotten to this moment in time. Because it's not just technology's fault, right? You can't just say that because there's iPhones and TikTok and Twitter that people aren't engaged in normal conversations anymore, for example. Technology is part of it, but society has gone along with it, right? Society has accepted this idea that individuals are invincible. Society has also evolved or maybe devolved in their trust of institutions and expertise and science. And so there is definitely sometimes a sense that families don't trust me, don't trust the hospital, don't even trust the idea of medical science. Those are not common, but they create these untenable relationships where it doesn't matter how I communicate, it doesn't matter what's happening, it's almost unsalvageable. How can you communicate the science of death to people who either don't believe in science or don't believe in inevitability, in fatality? It's challenging, and I feel like it's getting worse, certainly in North America, practiced in the United States and Canada, and I don't see this getting any better. And so I think that was another reason I feel so passionately about the topic of this book, that I don't think this is going to get better. I think this dilemma, this gray zone, these contentious conversations that happen at the end of somebody's life are only going to get more contentious and more gray as technology evolves and society evolves in this direction that is less trusting of each other, less trusting in science, and more self-centered. And this is true in terms of how social media feeds you information. This is true in terms of our general attitudes towards education and politics and life, is that we're becoming a little bit more self-focused and self-centered. And with that comes this expectation that, well, why would I die? You know, just because the doctor says I'm too sick to survive. I mean, screw that. I'm going to keep going. And there's something admirable about that spirit to survive. I understand that. But at some point in time, it just becomes incongruent with reality. There's only so much medicine can do. And medicine is only supposed to help people. It's never supposed to hurt people. And when we apply too much of it at the end of life, we are hurting people. We're poking, we're prodding, we're prolonging suffering. It's a problem.
Is it possible to define what it means to be alive from a physician's point of view?
Yeah, well, I can make death black and white. I know when somebody is totally dead, when they're dead, when they're never going to wake up again. That I can say with great certainty. It's harder when people haven't quite crossed that line yet, though. They're not totally dead. I mean, they're super sick. They're dying. Their body physiology is falling apart, but they're not dead yet. And because of the technology, the medicines, the science that we have today, I can kind of drag it out a long time before they're actually dead.
Is there a conflict, Blair, with how doctors see, well, how doctors define or see death? Because there's the somatic and neurological answer of what death is, isn't there?
Yeah, so we can have, you know, using technical terms, we have somatic death when your heart's not beating anymore. We have brain death when your brain has ceased to function in a way that is permanent and not recoverable. And in those cases, doctors, I think, have a lot of clarity on death. But what we know is that for some families, that's not good enough. For some families, they don't always understand that death has arrived, particularly with brain death, because people are still warm, they still have heartbeats. And so families can find it challenging to accept that recovery is impossible. But for physicians, I think it's very clear when death has permanently arrived. But in the ICU and in the emergency department, we deal with these people who are just on the brink of death. They're on the cliff's edge. And we can throw everything at them. We can try to prevent them from falling off that cliff. But sometimes it's pretty clear that all we're doing is delaying the inevitable. I mean, other times it's not so clear, right? Like, they come in, they're dying, they're young, they're otherwise healthy, and we're going to throw everything we've got at that person in hopes of getting them back to where they were. But at some point in time, you know, maybe it's a few days later, maybe it's a few weeks later, we start to realize that it's not working, that we've reached the limits of medical science, that we're not able to help this person any longer. And that's what my book is really about. It's about finding that point in time when you recognize that your resuscitation has failed, that your science has failed. For doctors, it's very personal, right? It feels like we're giving up in a way, like we're not good enough. And trying to communicate to families that we're at a new point here. There's no more hope. It's time to help this person have some dignity and comfort at the end of their life.
You mentioned in part of the earlier chapters that your confidence in reporting death eroded over the years. Has that got something to do with technology as well as the families of the person not really understanding exactly what the situation is as well? Or was there another reason for that?
I think as somebody learning medicine, it does seem a little bit odd at times because declaring death becomes more about a matter of timing that is your choosing. When we do the brain death exam, we schedule it. You know, we'll say, oh, we'll do it at 10 a.m. It's very weird to schedule a time of death. For other people, they'll say, oh, you know, we want to let our mother pass in peace, but her son is flying in from the West Coast. Can you just delay the death a little bit longer? And so I say, sure, we can wait until the plane lands and they come and say goodbye. So I found it odd in training how death as a paramedic was very clear, like there was nothing more to do, that was it. I didn't have the choice to delay, it was just over. But in the hospital, in the ICU, we have more flexibility. And I think that's a bit of a weird concept, that death comes when we allow it to. Because there's really no alternative, like the person's going to die, there's nothing else we can do to turn that around. But we can use this technology to be flexible in the timing of death. Now, I mean, that assumes that the family and the healthcare team are on the same page. There are times when that doesn't happen. And that gets into some pretty contentious and worrisome situations for people, where a good death can be lost, it can be dragged out, it can be painful, there can be suffering involved. And that's something that causes a lot of distress for families and for doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists who are caring for people.
Does technology prevent death from coming too soon, but also delaying its timely arrival?
So it used to be like when we didn't have technology, if your body was failing, it just failed, right? You died fast and that was the end of it. And people understood that. A lot of the time you would die in your own home, in your own bed, and your family would be surrounding you and they would see you die. And people would actually learn how to die by watching other people die. There was a lot of grace and dignity involved in it. Now with technology, we apply the technology in good spirit, right? Like we want the technology to support your body while it heals. So for example, if your heart is very weak, we can use special medications or machines to keep your blood flowing while the heart recovers. But maybe your heart is so injured from, I don't know, a heart attack or an infection that it's not going to recover. Well, when do we decide that, okay, it's not going to recover? Is it 2 weeks in? Is it 3 weeks in? And we can keep it going, but at some point we have to realize that it's not going to achieve what we had wanted it to achieve. And that moment, that sort of flipping of the switch from having hope to focusing on comfort and a good death, is a gray zone. It's very uncertain. Some people might call that moment too soon. Other people might call that moment too late. And that's really why I wrote this book, was because I wanted to make sure as a doctor, I was calling those moments at the right time.
In the book, you talk quite frankly about your relationship with religion as well as it being a segue into the conflict between death and religion. Do you mind touching on some of that a little bit, Blair?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people rely on their faith in times of stress and crisis, appropriately so. And often in the ICU, we'll hear people who are praying for a miracle. And I think that everybody would hope for a miracle when their loved one was dying. And I think doctors also hope for the unexpected. Maybe your chances are low, but, you know, we're hopeful that we can pull a rabbit out of a hat and achieve what some might think is impossible. And over history, we've done that, right? In the 50s, doing a heart transplant, that would have sounded totally insane. And now we do heart transplants all the time, and it works. People do great, right? Like, that's crazy. We took a heart out of one person's body and we put it in another. So the capability of medicine to pull off miracles is always evolving. And I think in religious contexts, people hope for God's intervention or their spiritual beliefs to lead to a miracle. But at some point in time, as a scientist, as a physician, it becomes very clear to me that a miracle is not possible. And at some point, it can become difficult to communicate that we've crossed the threshold of where prayers and miracles are possible to save somebody's life. So that's one aspect where religion, I think, conflicts with medicine at times. The other aspect is that there are people who hold beliefs quite commonly, although not necessarily consistently within a religion. So people might say to me, my religion doesn't allow me to turn off the ventilator. When people of the same faith or leaders of the same faith might actually disagree with that belief. So there's some heterogeneity even within very uniform religions around what it means to die and what it means to die by turning off a breathing machine, for example. And there have been some pretty creative religious ways of going about facilitating this. I've heard stories in some countries where there's a commonly held belief that you're not allowed to turn off a ventilator because it hastens a death, but that you can set a timer on the ventilator. And when the timer runs out, you just don't reset the timer. And so it's sort of a hands-off way of removing technology. There's also another piece to it where we make it sound like a choice. We say, would you like to turn off the ventilator? As if we can just leave it on forever. Like, that's not a choice. That's not something that we can do. So in some ways, I think physicians can take the responsibility that families are not wanting to hold themselves to account for, often for religious reasons. And I think that's my job as a physician, is to say, well, you don't need to make the decision to turn off the ventilator. I've talked to you about the situation. I've learned more about your loved one who's laying on this hospital bed, and I'm going to make the decision to turn off the ventilator. Because as this person's doctor, I feel that that is the reasonable choice here, to help them have a comfortable end, because I have reached the limits of medicine. I know that as a physician. And so I think too often physicians put that decision on family members. And that's part of the evolving history of physician autonomy and patient autonomy. Medicine used to be very paternalistic. We made a lot of decisions for people without involving them. And we've come a long way from that. But perhaps the pendulum has swung too far, right? We're putting too much. We're saying, well, you guys choose. The family can choose if this person dies today or tomorrow or the day after. But when the conclusion is evident, why would I make someone say, okay, pull the plug on my husband who I've been married to for 47 years? I would never want to make that decision personally for a loved one. That sounds like a very, very hard decision to make. Anybody who's ever had to lose a loved one, or even make the decision to take your pet to the vet to be put down, these are gut-wrenching decisions. And so often, I think maybe the physician can take the burden off the family and make that decision for them after learning about the circumstances and talking to the family and knowing that the family is aligned with that advice and that recommendation without making them explicitly sign on the dotted line. I think that's very reasonable. But I think our culture has pushed so far away from paternalism into patient autonomy that we've forgotten how to give advice and act on our own advice without making it all the family's determination. I'm not talking about withdrawing care when the family is not ready for that decision. What I'm talking about are sort of semantics and subtleties of having these discussions with families where somebody will look at a family and say, well, what do you want to do? Why don't we just say the reasonable thing here is for me to turn off the ventilator and I think they'll die within a couple of minutes peacefully. I can make that recommendation. And if the family says, we trust you, if that's what you think is best right now, and that's where we're at, and the science has failed us, and the technology has failed us, and the disease is just too burdensome, then let's go down that road. But the family doesn't have to explicitly say that. I think we need to find the right balance in the ICU and the emergency department to help families along.
It's interesting you say find the right balance, because I remember you mentioned in a book that it's almost as if the pendulum swung so far that physicians are now asking families to make difficult decisions at a difficult time. And it makes me think, what job can doctors and just physicians in general do in order to have more of a bond between or relationship between the families as well as the patients for those difficult moments?
I'll add something quickly to that. During the pandemic, we lost the opportunity for that frequent contact, for that relationship building, for that mutual trust to develop. We had to make phone calls. Usually the phone calls were made at the end of the day. I had a call sheet like, oh, I had to call 8 families. Maybe I was rushed. It was the end of the day, you know. It wasn't normal. It wasn't business as usual. And so it was hard to build that trust with families. And I think that that's a lesson the pandemic has taught us, that having families in the ICU, in the emergency department, with the doctors and nurses, following, watching what we're doing, seeing all the effort that we put into saving a life, I think families come on that journey with us to realize when it's time to flip the switch. And the pandemic did a great disservice to patients and families and healthcare teams by eliminating that contact, by separating that. And I know that those decisions were made in the interest of safety, but I think when the next pandemic comes, we can't do that again. I think that decision was far more harmful to that process in the ICU and emergency room than it was helpful to preventing one or two people from getting COVID.
You mentioned actually an interesting point in the book, and that's how ICU patients make hospitals money as well. Could you explain how that is the case, Blair?
Yeah, this is more of a United States phenomenon than a Canadian phenomenon. In Canada, ICUs cost money, and ICU patients in ICUs cost a lot of money. And so you would think in Canada, we would be more inclined to have people die when there's nothing more we can do for them. In the United States, it does get a little bit more difficult and uncomfortable because ICUs make a ton of money. There's high reimbursement for ICU stays. And so patients in the ICU who hang around for a few extra days longer than they ought to, nobody really has a problem with that. There's no pressure to be judicious with your ICU beds the way there is in other countries like the UK and Canada. And so that's one part of it. The other part of it, in the United States, there's a lot of metrics around healthcare. They're inspired by the idea that having metrics makes quality better. But what that does is everybody can game any system. And if a key performance indicator is how long you survive after a surgery, as is often an indicator in the United States, there are crude thresholds, 90 days, 30 days, 360 days. They're somewhat arbitrary, usually related to just the calendar. You have to live a full year after your lung transplant. You have to live 28 days after your hospital surgery for the surgery to be considered a success. And so there is certainly this undertone in the United States that I think most people down there personally acknowledge, although it's not often spoken about, that we're going to use every single bit of technology and science we can to keep you alive until we hit those metrics. And there's a bit of a disingenuous talk that that's in the best interest of the patient. But at some point in time, usually before those metrics are met, everybody knows that the game is up, but we drag it out, not so much for the patient's benefit at that point, but because we want to hit that statistical benchmark. That's not new. Like, people know about this. It's just not spoken about very often. And I think it's very hard for patients to pick up on that and to advocate for themselves, because there's a lot of false hope being thrown out at those points.
I think off the back of that, within that chapter, you mentioned just the quality or even lack thereof quality of life that some of the patients have after they've been in ICU for such a long extended period of time, which was very interesting to hear about. There's just one last thing I'd like to ask you, Blair, as well, is You spoke to many other accomplished doctors and physicians and historians while you're writing the book. Is there anything which someone said to you that stuck out to you or that made you reflect quite deeply?
Yeah, I guess I'm very young, right? I just finished my ICU fellowship recently. And so I am naive and new to this. And you probably get a sense of that in the book as I'm sort of talking about my own journey into understanding this flipping of the switch. And I spoke to a lot of ICU doctors all over the world, many more than I talk about in the book, who had been doing this job for 30 or 40 years. And what was really surprising to me is that many said, you know, you're bang on. A lot of people die too late. But I was cautioned. I got a bit of a slap on the wrist saying, careful what you wish for, because you don't want people to die too early. And in a way, I was a bit naive when I started writing the book, because I didn't realize that the real challenge here is knowing when to flip the switch. Because if you flip that switch too soon, if you decide this isn't working, these machines aren't going to cut it, this person's too sick to benefit, then there's this self-fulfilling prophecy where that person's going to die, right? Because you're not going to support them with medical intervention anymore. And who knows, maybe if you had tried harder, maybe if you had used more technology, they might have survived. And I have been surprised and humbled in my short period of practice. There have been patients who I would have sworn, I would have bet a lot of money in Vegas that they never would have survived. And they walked out of the hospital, or they came back and visited 6 months later and they were walking and they came with a basket of gifts and their family members. And you just go, wow, like, it worked. I cannot believe that. And then it kind of scares you, because you go, oh man, what if I had flipped the switch too soon? And so I think that realization was the most surprising thing about this book for me. And speaking to intensivists with more experience than me, I realized that, yes, dying too late is a very, very bad thing, and it happens far too commonly. But there's also a phenomenon that can happen of dying too early, of not having that chance. And we saw this a lot in COVID. Families would say, patients would say, no, don't put them on the ventilator. They're probably going to die of COVID. Everyone's busy. Give the ventilator to somebody else. Like, really touching conversations with people where they said, no, we just don't want to bother with all of this. Let's just die peacefully. And for the most part, we accommodated that because we were busy and overwhelmed. And we were kind of like, oh my goodness, thank the Lord that you don't want this last machine I have. Now I can save it for somebody else. And I wonder how many people weren't offered critical care or declined critical care who might have actually pulled through. And that's the type of thing where my colleagues say, Blair, you need to shut up. Like, we don't want to talk about that. And it sounds like now I'm capitulating, like I'm on both sides of the fence here. It's because I don't know how to sit on the fence. I don't know how to flip the switch at the right time. I think I do, right? After 19 years of medical education, I hope I know, but maybe I don't. And that's what other intensivists with more experience told me, was you need to be very humble. You need to be very patient. You need to talk to families and understand everybody's biases and values, because sometimes people do pull through who you don't expect to pull through. And so it becomes a real dilemma at that point, because there's consequence to dying too late, but there's also Great consequence to dying too early, obviously.
That was Dr. Blair Bigham, author of the book Death Interrupted: How Modern Medicine is Complicating the Way We Die. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or give a listen to. A big thanks to Blair for coming on, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the other previous episodes if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you in the next. Thank you.